strange days indeed. On Montreal's News Talk Leader, CJAD 800, and News Talk 1010, CFRB in Toronto. To talk to Errol Bruce Knapp, call 1-866-866-7387.
Or you can email us. The address is sdi@virtuallystrange.net. The Ozarks UFO Conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, happening next weekend. If you've just joined us, we've had Don Ledger on. He's leaving first thing tomorrow morning to drive down there, and he'll be the first speaker at the conference. And also speaking at the conference is Linda Moulton Howe. She's been in and around ufology and the field, and literally out in the fields. How long have you been out there doing it, Linda Howe?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, let's see. In terms of trying to get to the bottom of the animal mutilation mystery, which was my first step into Earth's mysteries, it would have been in the fall of 1979. And prior to that, all of my work in television as a producer, writer, director, and editor was focused on environment, science, and medical shows and series and live studio and news programs. And that started when I did my work at Stanford in 1966 to 1968. I graduated with a master's degree in which my work was with the Stanford Linear Accelerator and the Stanford Medical Center for the 2 years that I was there in the university, producing documentaries. So that my focus leaving Stanford was always in science, medicine, and the environment. It never changed.
Mm-hmm.
I have, frankly, become quite sensitive to that word ufology, paranormal, or any of that. Because from my point of view as an investigative reporter and television producer, we're talking about hard physical phenomena that leaves physical traces. And that's animal mutilations, that's crop circles, that's the megalithic structures off the western tip of Cuba, whatever they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes phenomena such as the strangely affected bed sheet in Corguinho, Brazil, and the wood in the ceiling that you and I, we talked briefly about this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this, to me, adds up to exactly where I started in my career has always been, which is you go to the scientists, you go to the medical people, you go to the pathologists, you go to anybody that can help you study hard physical evidence. And then as a reporter and as a TV producer, I've tried to share whatever subject I was working on. And in the case of 79 to 2004, I think that's about 25 years now.
Mm.
Even though I have done tremendous amounts of other production for UNICEF and Turner Broadcasting and PBS and so forth, I have always had this sort of ongoing question. What is it that the United States government knows about the interaction of something that seems to not fall into a human category interacting with humans, plants, and animals on this planet, and why do they stick with a policy of denial, basically a cover-up since at least the Truman administration? And I will be talking about that at the X conference in Washington, but at the Eureka Springs conference, I'm going to be focusing on another Earth mystery, which is the issue of the strange megalithic structures off the western tip of Cuba, which overall, in the end, might be related to all of these other Earth mysteries if, in fact, there have been many more civilizations on this planet beyond Sumeria, which has been sort of the line drawn in the sand as the beginning of so-called writing, math, and intelligent civilization. It might be that Cuba and other underwater archaeological discoveries on the planet are pointing yet again to the fact that there may have been a series of some kind of civilization or civilizations on this planet over a longer period of time. And as Zechariah Sitchin has raised in his work for, what, decades, could it be that inspiring some of the evolution anyway of the human evolution on this planet, has it been something off-planet? And I have found so interesting in my medical work that when you get into the issue of DNA and the evolution of DNA, and you're reading strictly from genetic and medical texts over and over again, even Watson and Crick, who received the Nobel Prize for the discovery of the double helix formation of the DNA, they raised the question, how could it be possible that on a planet that is 8,000 miles in diameter, 25,000 miles circumference, how could you have the same universal DNA everywhere on the planet if only evolution from a sea with lightning, which was the old hypothesis, were responsible for life? And in fact, one of those scientists did a brilliant paper that was published in an Icarus journal. The Icarus is the very respected astronomy journal. This goes back to about 25 years ago as well. And in that article, they raised the question, could DNA, the one single DNA in every known life form on the Earth, be universal because it was planted here? And I'm serious, they are the ones who have supported the idea of panspermia, the planting of DNA from off-planet onto the planet. Now, some scientists in all of this will argue, well, maybe it came in on comets. But then again, maybe Zechariah Sitchin and others are right, and this comes full circle back to the issue of Earth mysteries that range from animal mutilations to crop circles to the human abduction syndrome, and the overriding question, what does the government of the United States and its allies know about all of this, and why for 50-some years have they insisted on a policy of denial?
Wow, that's a mouthful.
that other voice is Victor Vigiani, who's in studio with me here, Linda Moulton Howe.
Hi.
Hello, Linda.
I wanted to ask you how megaliths fitted into the Ozarks UFO conference, but I think you pretty much covered it all there, and thanks for your time, Linda.
Well, I hope so, and I thank you, and I'm really looking forward. This is the 16th year that Lou Farish has had the persistence and the courage year after year to bring together in, I personally think it's one of the single most delightful conferences anywhere in the world, and I've been to a lot of them in other countries as well. And having the Inn of the Ozarks with its conference center and the restaurant and the ability for everybody to get together every night at what they call the Lone Star Bar and talk about everything that everyone is learning from speakers during the day, surrounded by, it can be dogwood, red buds in the spring, it really truly is a kind of unique event, and 16 years in running, and I hope that a lot of people will get there this year, even though it is on Easter weekend.
I have a feeling that there will be a lot of people, as we were saying to Don Ledger earlier on, because it is Easter weekend. It's a long weekend, and people will be able to get there and then travel back afterward, although it is a somewhat early start and early finish on Sunday morning, I understand.
That's true, but I can tell you, out of those last 16 years, I've been there, I believe, 13 or 14 of the 16 years, and two or three times it has fallen on Easter weekend, and it's because Lou Farish is locked into a cycle with the Inn of the Ozarks, and sometimes it lands on Easter. And for those listening, there is no more beautiful place with a gorgeous cross and just an absolutely breathtaking place to spend Easter.
And we'll be spending an hour at the Lone Star Bar ourselves next week on this program. So,
well, good.
Yeah, so we've tied in the Ozark Conference with this program for the last couple of weeks. It's been an interesting experience just talking to people, some of them that I haven't talked to before and some that I have. cattle mutilation was your first connection with all of the things that you've been into over the years. Was that as a freelance journalist, investigative journalist, or did some a news director somewhere say, Linda, go cover this?
Oh, no. I had been working inside of TV stations from Stanford on, and I had worked in KNBC in Los Angeles right out of school as a street reporter. And then I was asked to work as both an associate producer and then a producer at KNBC in Los Angeles, producing shows having to do with environmental issues. And I was married at the time, and my husband went to Harvard for his MBA, and that's why I left Los Angeles and was hired to be the producer of all the medical and science television production at WCVB in Boston while he was getting through Harvard. And after he graduated with his master's in business degree from Harvard, he was hired by Time Incorporated's video unit, American Television Communications, and we went to Denver, and I was hired directly from the Boston station, the ABC affiliate, by the CBS affiliate, which was KMGH in 1976, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there producing documentaries and live television studio shows and news segments for 7 years as director of special projects for the CBS station. And it was in the process of those, I mean, I had done a series on pollution that had a national Emmy nomination, went back to New York for those ceremonies, as well as I had received several regional Emmys and other awards for the work that I had done in environmental and science production when, in the summer of 1979, I was working on a completely different production, but my audio guy, Mark O'Kane, had just come off of a shoot for 2020. And he was telling me that they had shot for several weeks. They had shot, we were all working in double, what's called double system then, in the field that was running 16 millimeter with a Nagra and quarter inch, and then having to go back and transfer quarter inch to a full coat and loop it up in sync with the 16 millimeter. And the reason why I'm stressing that is if you shot over 60, 70, 80,000 feet of double system film and audio back then, that was a hell of a story.
Yeah.
And Mark O'Kane, who was working for me on a documentary, told me that ABC 2020 had shot, I think it was over 100,000 feet of film. And I, what's happening with this story? Because what was the subject? Animal mutilations. And it was Mark O'Kane telling me about 2020, spending all of this time, and he told me that while the ABC network crew was out in all of the various fields, that they were continuously having battery problems. They would have full-loaded batteries, and the batteries would run down. They had all kinds of bizarre things happening. He said it was a very spooky shoot, and he wondered what was happening. And I called up, as director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver, the executive producer on 2020 at that time, can't remember his name right now, might have been Rune Arledge, and I explained who I was and said that my audio guy on a production that I was doing in Denver told me that he had been involved with a shoot, huge amount of film about animal mutilations, and I wanted to know what were they going to do, when were they going to air it, and to my complete surprise, the executive producer at the ABC network said, oh, no, we've scrapped it because we're in the business of hard news and we could never get an answer to the mutilations. I heard that. I was totally taken aback that they would have spent all that money and time and then just scrapped it because they couldn't get a hard answer. I would think that that would have motivated them even more.
Well, you would have thought so, a hard news organization.
Exactly. And I come from a hard news background for my entire career. So I was boss of the department, and I said, well, I'm going to try to find out what's at the bottom of these animal mutilations. I literally thought that it was going to be a, I'm not kidding, I thought it would be a four-month project. I would have some kind of an answer. I would do the documentary for broadcast like I'd already done. I mean, in my career, I've done 25, 30 documentaries for TV and various things. And it would just be another one. Well, 9 months later, enforced by the fact that the station and the general manager were willing to support me with the money and the time to keep working on a project that normally I never went longer than 4 months, and they gave me double the time. And on May 25th, 1980, in a two-hour special, my film, A Strange Harvest, was first broadcast. And I did the classic documentary scenario route in which the crew and I traveled for over a month in a station wagon, in which the story was leading me. We didn't have any pre-programmed sites. I did have some sheriffs, and I had some ranchers to go to initially, and they kept feeding, and we ended up going up into Wyoming. We ended up going in a loop from Colorado to Wyoming, back down through Colorado to new things that were happening. We went into New Mexico. And over that period of time, everything was happening live around me, and that is what we were covering for the film, in addition to the fact that animal mutilations had been a public mystery, meaning they had been publicized in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and all of the weekly news accepted vehicles from the early 70s on. And the stress, this was not isolated to Colorado. This is a worldwide phenomenon. And I had newspapers and headlines in magazines like Newsweek and Time that went back to the early 70s. But then I began finding that there were newspaper stories in places like Huntsville, Alabama, going back to 1961. And eventually it was Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, at the 50th anniversary of the alleged crash of something in Roswell in July of 1997, we all gathered in that same hangar where allegedly some of the parts or debris from the notorious Roswell incident was taken. And Lieutenant Colonel Corso had written a book called The Day After Roswell, which had come out in that July of 1997 time period, and I was being introduced to him for the first time, and he said, "Linda Howe, I just want to know how you got so much classified information in your documentaries and your books." And that opened up a discussion with him in which he told me that he had seen with his own eyes when he came back from World War II and having been stationed in Italy, and he was now in Washington working for the Eisenhower administration and then later the Kennedy administration. And he said that while he was back in Washington at the end of the Eisenhower administration, that he read documents about the unusual deaths of animals around the world in which the same excisions of tissue were taken without blood or without tracks, and that these top-secret classified reports had dates as early as 1951, which would have been 4 years after all of the so-called alleged Roswell incidents, and that in the documents that he read with his own eyes, he insisted that they were linking, the word mutilation was not used then. It was the unusual bloodless, trackless deaths of the animals linked to, and he said this was typed in the reports, to extraterrestrial biological entities. And hearing this from Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso, who unfortunately passed away the next year, God rest his soul, but being able to hear him directly say that to me about his own experience, reinforced what I found when I talked with law enforcement from the beginning of the research on A Strange Harvest, starting in Colorado and then branching out, talking to the RCMP in Canada and talking with Lynn Lauber in Calgary who was then head of the animal mutilation investigation there, and Lynn Lauber saw my documentary, A Strange Harvest, which basically came down to the law enforcement telling me, we're operating the camera and I'm asking who or what do you think is killing and mutilating these animals around the world and why, and finally got on the record, Lou Girodo, head of the district attorney office investigation in mutilations down in southern Colorado, and he said, well, investigators and I have come to the conclusion we're not dealing with humans, we're dealing with something from outer space. And that was in the fall of 79 when Lou Girodo said that on camera. A Strange Harvest was broadcast May 25th, 1980, and that year Lynn Lauber with the RCMP was calling me and asking to see A Strange Harvest, and we had private conversations on the phone in which he admitted that the so-called satanic cult explanation that the RCMP had floated, I believe that was the way it said, had floated in Canada, was their way to buy time and deflect the media because they knew that was not the answer, and that's why they were so interested in the documentary that I had done, A Strange Harvest, in which law enforcement in the United States were linking their experiences and their investigations to beams of light, luminosities, pulsing red light, orange lights that split in two, went into the ground, came out of the ground. All of that was why law enforcement told me that they were linking it to something not from this planet. And the interesting thing back then, because I was producing from 79 to 80, the only people that I could get to talk on the record in front of the camera with law enforcement, officially a sheriff's or in this case the DA's investigator, was the former sheriff from Sterling, Colorado, and Lou Girodo, the chief investigator down in southern Colorado. And those two people spoke honestly and straightforwardly on film. George Yarnell, who was the sheriff in Elizabeth, what he said to me off the record was incredible, and he would not talk about it on the record. And I found that I probably talked 9 out of every 10 law enforcement people that I talked to refused to go on the record about the extraordinary encounters with beams of light, disc-shaped objects, helicopters that were totally silent and evaporated in the air right above them. All of these things which I have written about, and I've been able to get a lot of civilians now after 25 years. I have, I think, now a dozen people, of which only 2 of those will go on the record, but I've talked with at least a dozen people who have seen a beam of light come down into a pasture, have watched an animal go up in a beam of light or be dropped back down in a beam of light, or as one former cowboy in Sand Springs, Oregon, that I write about in Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, he watched a series of round, glowing objects in the sky above where he was in a trailer out in an area where his job as a cowboy was to keep track of what was happening with the cattle. And several nights back in the 70s, he saw these glowing, whatever they were, round in the sky, and watched beams come out of them. But what he heard was bodies dropping through the trees, and in the morning he would find the carcasses of mutilated cattle, and that they had fallen so hard that they had created craters with their own bodies.
Mm-hmm. Linda Howe is the voice that you're hearing. A Strange Harvest was the video. Also a book by the same title, wasn't it, Linda?
The book I did 10 years later called An Alien Harvest.
There we
and
go.
I specifically changed it from the documentary A Strange Harvest because I didn't really know for sure what the heck was going on.
Mm.
10 years later, An Alien Harvest, I had now had face-to-face discussions with people who had worked for the CIA, DIA, and others, and I knew for a fact that our government was covering up their knowledge
yeah.
that something off-planet was involved with animal mutilations around the world.
In the work that you did out in the field, did you take soil samples from around the areas where the animals were laying?
Later, W.C. Levengood, the biophysicist in Michigan.
There you go. I was going to hook it into Nancy Talbot's findings on the crop circle outside of Edmonton, Alberta, a couple of years back.
Yeah, Levengood and I started working together quite a long time before Nancy Talbot had worked with him
mm-hmm.
and her work later. The evolution was from 79 to, gosh, I guess 89. The work that I did was trying to get pathologists to help me examine tissue that I could go out into the field, cut it out of the animals, get them to pathologists to try to see what were these cuts, how were they cut, was there evidence of high heat, which there always seemed to be, but the confusion and the puzzlement to this day is we are carbon-based life forms. If you take a laser in surgery, whether it's gynecology or whatever it is, under a microscope, you're always going to see some residue of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
We got microscopic slides from gynecologists, from a whole bunch of people to study with John Altshuler, MD, pathologist, hematologist in Denver, highly respected, done work with the University of Colorado, then went into private practice. God rest his soul, he passed on this year. But he was the one pathologist who was willing in the end of the 80s to really work with me on a pretty persistent basis for 3 or 4 years. We learned a great deal, and it was in his work and getting comparisons between what we were seeing in the photomicrographs from the tissue slices from the various animals, and we had mutilated animals from cattle, horses, cats, rabbits, a whole wide spectrum, and nobody knows what the cutting instrument was.
Isn't that strange? Linda Moulton Howe speaking this coming weekend, Easter weekend, at the UFO Conference of the Ozarks in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. I need to go here, Linda, because back in July of last year, we had Brazilian UFO researcher A.J. Gavard on the program, and he and several other Brazilian researchers were really indignant. And they felt that you had been taken in by a man named Urandir Fernandes de Oliveira down there in Brazil. A man, AJ said, had been exposed as a hoaxer and a con man in Brazilian media. And you were down there investigating an alleged case of abduction of Urandir Fernandes de Oliveira. I don't know. It just...
May I?
Oh, please.
Come in here, please.
Of course, yeah.
Okay.
I just wanted to get it
all
out.
All right. Cause... I think you all have heard me describe that through my television and film career that goes back to graduating from Stanford in 1968, I have always gone to the field, to the person, to the first hand. And in being in Brazil, what I learned about Mr. Gavard from other people is that he is only a self-referencing person who did not do any independent research whatsoever, because there had been a terrible series of legal allegations between Urandir Oliveira and A.J. Gavard going back long before the September 2002 incident that I went down to investigate. So let's make sure that you're not holding up that man as some sort of reference of objectivity.
What I said was that there were several Brazilian UFO researchers who were indignant about it. And
I don't think so. I think they were just doing his bidding. But listen, let's just go and stay on the positive track of what are facts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I wanted to at least leave your listeners with was a place to reference the animal mutilation investigations, the crop circles, the Corguinho, Brazil, Urandir Oliveira case, and that is at my website, which is www.earthfiles.com. And, for example, I have just typed in the quick search, and there I've done 45 reports on ongoing animal mutilations up into this year, And so that people know this is a phenomenon that has been going on for over 50 years and is ongoing and has been in the nation of Argentina in great numbers and continues in many countries of the world on a regular basis, and that you can go and see images of what these animals, what happens to the soil, what happens to the plants, what happens at the excisions at earthfiles.com. I keep up on a constant and regular basis with what is happening with crop formations, which I think is also a very fundamental earth mystery that is affecting soil and plants in a very physical way.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the Uringer Oliveira case in Corguinha, Brazil, set aside whatever are the politics, let's just talk about the physical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I went there for. And I gathered from the room where there was the strange body pattern on the cotton and polyester woven bedsheet, samples with Mr. Oliveira's permission. I gathered some of the wood from the ceiling that seemed to be scorched. Gathered from a variety of people who had gathered up these strange round stones that many people talked to me, not just Mr. Oliveira, who had been on the farm. He has cousins, his parents, his wife's family. There were a variety of people who were there. This is not, as some people have claimed, some kind of a cult situation. It is a working farm. Everybody worked very hard the 2 weeks that I was there in February of 2003 all the time. Uringer Oliveira was constantly dealing with irrigation broken pipe problems, tractor problems. It was a working farm, and it is a working farm.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of talking with people through translators about what happened on the night of September 15th, learning that there were people there from the family, from one of the local towns. A lot of people love to go into that area. It is absolutely beautiful to hike the hill, the hills on the aside from that big mesa that overlooks the valley. And they said that at approximately 7:30 p.m., which was verified by a videotape, that Fabricio da Silva heard this loud knocking on the metal roof of this little place that he was in, scared the living daylights out of him. He said he just didn't know what to do. Finally, he picked up his little digital camera and ran outside, remembering that this man, Uringer Oliveira, who has said that he's had ongoing interactions with something in the non-human category of tall blondes with vertical pupils and blue eyes, which is not a unique description. There are people from England to the United States and Canada who the last 30-some years have described encounters with alleged tall Nordic types with blue eyes and vertical pupils. His description is consistent with people in other parts of the world over three or four decades.
Mm.
And that these beings had interacted with him, Uringer Oliveira, since age 13. He's described them. He has drawn them. He has talked about this would have been the fifth, I believe, abduction event, and that he had been forewarned that this would occur and there would be a dropping of stones. And it's too bad, I guess, we're at the end of the time.
Yeah, we are.
You want me to stay on for one more segment? But Grant is next.
Yeah, Grant and Bob Demers.
Go to earthfiles.com to read about what the University of Pennsylvania found about the stones and what one of the largest textile labs in the United States, what the director said about this extraordinary bedsheet that I was able to get completely from Brazil to the United States for examination.
Linda Moulton Howe, I want to thank you for being with us tonight, and do have a good time, as I'm sure you will, at the Ozarks Conference next week. And it was good talking to you again.
And thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
We will come back, and Grant Cameron will join us. Linda Moulton Howe's website, again, earthfiles.com, or get to it from tonight's program listing. Be back with Victor Vigiani and some interestings, Canadian interestings this time.
Strange days indeed. UFO News Talk Radio on Montreal's CJAD 800 and 1010 CFRB in Toronto.